when I every time I get in, I think, shit, man, I have to recalibrate immediately. I just think it is going to kick off. I'm going to get in trouble. I'm going to get in a fight, or I'm going to get hurt, or something bad is going to happen. Yeah, I really do. I feel like, be careful, be careful. Okay, recalibrate, recalibrate. Because it's all, it's just a totally different mindset. Everyone is moving at a completely different pace.
Things you're in a that, attack zone. You're in a
things that
attack defense.
I've got to be much less sensitive to things that I think might be rude or obnoxious, all that sort of stuff.
You need to re-brutalize when you hit the streets of London.
You really do.
Yeah, it's doggy.
Or just let it bounce off you. That's the thing. I think that's the key.
I'm too porous for London.
Right.
Every street corner just. There's something happening that just affects me deeply.
Yes.
Either in a positive, joyful, gleeful way, or as a depressing, are you all right way.
Yeah, exactly. It's too much, man. I mean, it's crazy. It's like just the amount of people in, you know, just 50 years ago. If you every day in London now looks like New Year's Eve. You know what I mean? it's fucking rammed and. Can't move, and it's all just,
why are you all partying here? I'm trying to get to work.
Yeah,
it's true. So you're near Norwich, you're not in Norwich.
No, we're outside. Are we rolling? Yeah,
we're always rolling.
Soft open. Oh, love. So, it
is that good, a soft open?
I love a soft open.
You're the master. That's steady the thing on. I feel sort of I very rarely feel intimidated, but you have made this genre your own, have you not?
Wow.
That it's is,
but we went from the soft open to the hard compliment.
Hard flattery. I mean, that's sort of the hardest flattery I've done. It was almost brutal.
You couldn't even look me in the eye while
no,
you were doing it.
No, I couldn't. I got coy. It came out not unlike me. It's like, this is going to be some really intense loving.
I love it.
But it's true.
Watch me deal with this flattery. Yes, Sue. I'm glad you're giving me the respect I deserve, because I am the master of this. Can we swear?
Yeah.
Motherfucking medium.
Yes.
And I more or less created it. It's been set up in my image. All the so-called champions of the genre have come after me and taken from me, maybe a little bit from Joe, and not given us any credit. Mark Maron sat there with fucking Barack Obama, as he keeps reminding us. In his garage.
I'd never heard that. He's never mentioned it.
He wouldn't be anywhere if it wasn't for me and Joe having come along, admittedly, after Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant, and exploring the medium back in 2006, I think we started on XFM. But yeah, now, I mean, I've lucked out. I've found a medium that agrees with me. But I certainly did see the potential fairly early on.
But it's perfectly lo-fi.
Exactly.
You're the master of lo-fi. And I mean that again as a hard, hard piece of flattery.
Thank you.
And it suits lots of comics in the sense that it's just got an intimate kind of shambolism to it that we gravitate to.
Yeah, man. It's the best for the rambly, meandering conversation. I can't think of another medium that does justice to those rhythms and those pauses and longers. And
also the sort of tangential shit that people lob in.
Exactly.
That you wouldn't get in a formal interview, because formal interviews tend to be very on brand, on message. Have you ever had any guests that sort of have not really got the podcast form, and they've been sort of too sort of primped?
Yep. I don't want to mention names, but yes, they do come along. I was talking to your producer, Dan, earlier on, before you arrived.
He's a bastard.
He's a terrible guy. He's not in the room right now.
No, he's not. Thank God he's not here watching us.
He's got a grotesque accent. I think he's from Belfast. I could barely understand what he was saying. He had to write it down.
He's dressed, actually, as some people from Belfast are, as Khaleesi, as the mother of dragons from Game of Thrones.
That's right.
Yeah, and I have to say, it works, doesn't it, for him?
Got to hold myself back from going. Well, can we pick up that tangent in a second?
Yeah, park it and we'll return.
All right, that's not what I'm. It's one thing I'm really bad at doing.
I've got Khaleesi on the brain, so it's all right. We'll come back to that.
But no, Dan is sat in the room with us, beautiful Belfast, home of Van Morrison and all wonderful things.
So bad guests.
But bad, we were talking about the politics of podcasts and booking guests and trying to create a selection of guests that isn't all just your mates. And, you know, if it's me, most of the people I know are other kind of middle-aged white guys. And so, you do, you know, you're trying to look around for people that you don't know very well or that you think are interesting, but you haven't met them before. And then you start, once you're on the radar a little bit, you start getting approaches from PR companies and people plugging books or films or TV shows or whatever. And some of those are people that you're interested in and excited to talk to. And they're often dangled in front of you. Do you want to talk to Jordan Peele? Yes, I want to talk to Jordan Peele.
Yeah.
He's great. But, and then it's like, when can I talk to Jordan Peele? And then they say, oh, well, you can talk to him for half an hour on Tuesday. And then you think, oh, I can't do Tuesday. And then...
Did you blow out Jordan Peele because of your schedule?
Yeah.
No.
Because I'm doing the school run on Tuesday and I have to take out the bins. So I can't do Tuesday. Is there any other time I could talk to Jordan Peele? No, he doesn't live in England. He's on a press junket. You've got half an hour, you can fuck off. So I had to fuck off.
That's painful because I love Jordan Peele.
Absolutely. So you're sort of thinking, well, half an hour with Jordan Peele is better than no Jordan Peele. On the other hand, is it really? Because he's just going to be in junket mode. You're not going to get anywhere. He's just going to be selling his film perfectly reasonably. We're not going to make any kind of meaningful connection. And that's always the hope. If you're talking, having a long-form conversation with someone, you do want to get beneath that sell mode.
Yeah.
Beneath the on-brand.
And also a podcast, of course, there are half-an-hour podcasts, but the Jordan Peele, you want a good hour, just more, maybe. Just.
Yeah. Well, I did say yes to Greta Gerwig under similar circumstances. You
Amazing.
Know. I thought, well, that's got to be worth it. And she was a bit more, she gave me a bit more time. So it wasn't ideal in that it was still one of those things in a hotel room where there's guards standing there making sure you don't say the wrong thing. And
that's what you want. You want armed personnel at a podcast.
It's more or less like
keep you on track.
You know, as soon as you mention Woody Allen, everyone tenses up and they start cocking their rifles, you know. But it was still worth it and she was cool and she's one of those people who is able to switch from cell mode to something a little bit more real.
Mm.
At least that's the way it felt. I mean, she's a very talented actor, so maybe it was pretend.
Maybe she was just suckering you into a false sense of security.
But it was good. But yeah, you have to pick and choose. However, there are times definitely where you are... I think it happens a lot more in the music industry. They really couldn't give a fuck. They're just like, look, we got a pop star... Do it on our terms. You can talk to them on our terms. It has to go out on this date. You can't talk about this, this, and this, but it's a big pop star, so you better do
what
we tell
you. Have they ever listened to your
show? I don't know. I think they have, and they like it, and they just think, oh, yeah, this is...
They're going to know that you're not going to do, like, 10 minutes of sort of hardcore kind of muck-busted chats promoting an album, and then that's it.
Yes. But even then, you know, you have the conversation, but you really feel as if the person on the other end of the conversation hasn't listened to the podcast, doesn't know / care about you, and it's...
Then that's even worse because it means you're hitting certain metrics. You've got to that stage now where the podcast's obviously got a sufficient reach in inverted commas. Isn't that what they talk about? The reach.
Right.
The scope, the scale. It's hitting the right demographics.
Sure.
And then the avalanche of requests from...
Avalanche.
That's what it's like.
Yeah.
That's what an avalanche sounds like.
Like Roxy Music.
So yeah, okay. Just exactly a sort of soft focus on a falsetto-y vibe.
People in dinner jackets being consumed by clouds of snow.
Well, it starts off as powder. It starts as avalanche! And then it just, just descends.
There's a loud sound in the mountains.
It's I'm so scared. You've done that before in a mirror. I know you have. That's too practice. There's no way that's just happened.
I got my GPS tracker
over
my ankle. Hope they find me quickly. It's not a good Brian Ferry impression.
How many times have you done Brian Ferry? is it long standing?
No, I've never done Brian Ferry.
Parties, so they go, Adam, can you?
No, I met Frank Black of the Pixies. We did an interview with him. And we did a thing called Vinyl Justice on our old TV show where we'd go through people's record collections dressed as cops. Doing funny cop accents, because that's how cops talk. So we're going through people's house. What you got here, Mr. Frank Black? Going through your criminal records. Brian Ferry, do you like Roxy Music? And he said, oh, yeah, I love Roxy Music. And he just went, and we were like, what are you doing? What's that? What's that noise? That's Brian Ferry. And so we were like, oh, it's like a sort of sexy pony noise.
Yeah, but going down the scale, really.
Yeah.
This real craft there.
But I don't really associate that with Brian Ferry.
No, I don't either.
In every dream home, a heartache. And every step I take.
Is it awful that every time I think of Brian Ferry, I just think of his son now?
What does his son do? He's a hunt.
Crow hunt.
Loves hunting.
He is permanently in some sort of red jodhpurs, hallooing and braying through the English countryside. And I think sort of talks quite passionately about sort of eviscerating foxes.
Mate, come on.
There's a lot of sort of, yeah, but that's the fun. It's sort of seeing them ripped to pieces in front of you. There's a bit of that going on.
Yeah. It's funny, though, isn't it? Because he's a working class fellow, Brian Ferry, and now he's reinvented himself as this kind of lord of the manor.
Yes.
And bought into that whole world, lock, stock and barrel. And it always seemed to be his mission. And it's weird looking back at Roxy Music originally, because they seemed originally so subversive and countercultural in every way. But actually, with the exception of Eno, they really weren't.
Everyone, all those guys just go on to buy stately homes, don't they?
Yeah.
I mean, Damon Hirst bought a sort of 250 million quid pile and sort of lives in it. And he was supposed to be this sort of huge countercultural shark bisecting sort of behemoth of the new art world.
Yeah.
He's also, and they're all in jodhpurs. I think my that's dad, the end game.
When he was alive, I remember him coming back from a trip to America in the 70s and he said, do you know a band called Who?
Did you then go, Who?
Yeah, and we didn't, you know, we were like eight or something. I'd never heard of The Who. But my mum said, oh, The Who. He's like, yes, yes, The Who. I sat next to the singer. And we were like, and my mum said, Roger Daltrey. He's like, that's the fellow, yes. And he was very nice. And he has a trout farm. He told me we talked all about fishing on his estate. And that was the thing, is my dad was also this kind of reinvented working class guy who always wanted to be posh. And that was his whole mission. They were like, I found this out fairly recently, having known nothing about my parents whatsoever for ages, because I thought they were so boring. But then when I actually got down to, and my dad never talked about it or anything.
So he never talked about himself or his upbringing or?
Yeah, nothing. Because I think he was embarrassed that his parents were servants, like Downton Abbey style.
Yeah.
And so in that atmosphere, surrounded by these people, and it was a very, you know, kind of, it was that very much Downton Abbey symbiosis of upstairs and downstairs and both scratching each other's back, respect between the classes. They were looked after by their masters, whatever the word is, employers, and taken care of and, you know, well treated, etc. And through being their servants, they learned about how the upper classes lived. And the right
manners,
way to behave, manners, yeah. And the right forks to use for the courses and all that sort of stuff. And so they aspired to that life for themselves and for their children. And their idea was, well, our children will have access to this world and they will be able to live like this. And that would be the best thing to do, to be part of the establishment in that way. And so that's very much the niche that my dad carved out for himself, ended up working at the Telegraph and speaking with kind of cut glass, posh voice and liking those people and admiring those people, you know. And when he met someone like Roger Daltrey, all his prejudices about how awful pop music was fell away because he was a successful guy. Trout farmer.
But do you think it was a trout farm that made it? If he'd been a successful guy and still throwing TVs out windows and snorting coke off people's backs, then he would have...
I think he still would have been impressed.
So was it the money that impressed him?
Yeah, a lot, yeah, because he always struggled. He was no good with money, and he was always in trouble with money. So he was well impressed by people who'd made a pile and hung on to it, you know. And when he met Coolio, you know, he was not a rap fan. He didn't love rap.
Of course, Bad Dad met all these people.
Yeah, but he hung out with Coolio for a couple of days in Hollywood, And Coolio was recording an album with his band, who were called the 40 Thieves, with a Z at the end. And Coolio drove me and Joe and my dad around in his Humvee, playing music really, really loud. And my dad was just well impressed. He was like, look at this guy's car and look at this guy's studio and he's made it. And Coolio was charming and thought my dad was an oddity because as far as they were concerned, he was the real deal, super posh English guy. They got him in to record little bits for their album.
Did he?
Yeah, although they never showed up, I don't think, on the record. But he was in the booth and they wanted him to say things like, they wanted him to say hip hop things, but in his posh voice,
yeah.
You know, they said, okay, say, are you a writer? And my dad was like, are you a writer? No, man. Are you a writer? Like a writer, you're writing. Are you a writer? Oh, yes. Are you a writer? And all that. And they were just falling about laughing, everything he would say.
We did that once with, do you remember Patrick Allen?
The Protect and Survive guy.
Incredible dude. Yeah. We made him once, just for our own pleasure, record the lyrics to I'm Your Private Dancer by Tina Turner. It was literally, I'm your private dancer, a dancer for money. And he just did the whole song, and we've still got it on DAT, which is not a format.
Love DAT.
I think is
very high
what
end.
What can you do with DAT now?
You have to buy on eBay an incredibly expensive DAT player.
But it's that thing of just taking a genre and then getting somebody from a completely different world to voice it. But you say you didn't know much about your dad, but you travelled with him and you did all these shows with him. You must have...
That was always an exercise in trying to form some bond after the fact, you know what I mean? Like, I always fantasized that we would connect and get hammered on drugs at V Festival or whatever, and then everything would come out, and he would explain all about where he'd come from, and why he was the way he was, why he hated pop music so much, why it was so important for him, for us to be privately educated, all this kind of stuff that I'd always wondered about and had some hang-ups about, you know. But none of that ever happened,
never.
Really. No, it never did.
Did you have the painful fortune of being with him when he died?
Yes. And that was the final section when he got cancer, and I moved him into our place in Norfolk. We were lucky enough to have the space, like a little guest flat where he could move in, and we'd look after him with the help of nurses and stuff. And I thought that would be the period when the bonding would happen.
Yeah.
I had these fantasies of like everything would fall away. He'd be like, I'm sorry, I never did this and that. And we'd just be straight with each other. No.
I had the same thing with my dad.
Right.
It's like, you know, he moved him in and spent so much time with him. I gave up work. We were all looking after him because... And do you think you are going to break any minute now? And that sort of old school gent edifice is going to collapse. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be this tsunami of pain and frustration and sharing and emotional connection. Just right up to the absolute last drop of that morphine driver. The dude was on message. It was like...
No, not even a glimmer.
I managed to get him to repeat the phrase, not initiate, but repeat the phrase, I love you. And he did it almost as a, because I sort of said it at the end did you say I love you to your parents when you were growing up?
Yes.
See, we didn't do it. It was implied.
No, I love yous.
No, I love yous. But it was heavily implied. It was
We
were all happy.
Sure.
We didn't say it out loud. It was awkward.
I think I did. I can't remember now because I say it so much to my children.
Yeah.
And they say it to me, I'm glad to say.
That must be the best thing when it comes back.
Yeah, it's
I
funny.
Mean, I say it to everybody, but I don't, I just...
You don't mean it.
It wasn't a, oh God, I'm known for it. Sue, I mean, she'll say she loves it. She's shallow like that. I got him to say it, and that I remember was a supremely big deal.
Right.
I was felled by that. I was just crawling around the floor, just so overwhelmed with emotion that I got. And then after that, it's sort of, I don't know if you felt this with your dad, but it's like there's so much pressure in the not... divulging.
Mm-hmm.
They must have been so... I don't know, why not just say things? It's much easier to say things, but mm-hmm. imagine they've created these walls.
My dad viewed it as stoicism and, you know, a certain kind of conservative stoicism of not letting everything out, and he was dismayed by the way that in modern culture you are supposed to share. And you're seen as uptight if you don't. And obviously now there's oversharing. That's not necessarily good. Somewhere in between is nice.
Do you overshare?
I don't. I mean, I guess from my dad's point of view, I probably do. So that's the thing. I have his voice in my head all the time.
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
Bad jokes, and but also a very gentle, are you all right? Is everything okay? Mm-hmm. He was very good like that. He was very sensitive. So, yeah, he'll sort of marshal me sometimes, and I'll hear his voice very clear. When did your dad pass away?
End of 2015. So he missed out on all the fun in 2016, Brexit and Trump.
My dad got to 2016, sort of March 2016. Missed the vote.
Right, okay.
Missed that. It's odd because the voice has become clearer the further away from that event I am. It's, I don't know, same with you, but yeah. it is like he's just... So your dad is always saying, don't overshare. That's what he's mainly saying. Or you've gone a bit too far there. Or what is this emotion?
I do. I mean, I remember him very clearly saying one New Year's Eve when, you know, that phase, I don't know if you went through that phase where you suddenly started getting drunk in front of your parents, or at least, you know, that there was a long period when it was very important for me never to let my parents see me doing anything naughty. And then... maybe after you've moved out or whatever, it's like, well, obviously I don't really care anymore what they think. So get to, you know, have family get-togethers. Everyone gets a bit pissed. I got a bit pissed or something. And I started teasing my dad about being uptight or something. And everyone was having fun and everyone was a bit hammered. But I think I teased him a little pointedly and he just went, you go too far, Adam. You go too far. And I thought, shit, man, I've gone too far.
Oh.
And in that, the way he phrases, well.
You
go too far. It wasn't just that point. It was like, generally, that was a statement about
that's the sort of thing Alec Guinness would say in a really big David Lean film. And oh, man.
Today's episode is sponsored by OVO Energy, who've just launched OVO Beyond to help us all manage our carbon footprint. We use a huge amount of energy at home, with our individual home energy use making up 26% of our carbon footprint, which is about 1.7 tonnes of carbon. The new upgrade OVO Beyond is powered by a smart meter and brings you the green energy and digital tools you need to understand how you can lighten your carbon footprint and shrink your bills in one. The more of us that make small changes and take actions in our lives, the faster we'll reach zero carbon. Join us on a journey to zero carbon and search OVO Beyond today. OVO Energy, what we can do.
It feels like that generation of the last of the gentlemen, you know. My dad was came from a very working class family, but it was the sense of dressing up and manners and, you know, having things just so that has completely disintegrated now. It's just, I think we must appear as, even though, I mean, we're sort of, you know, of a certain age. I mean, but even to them, we must have been unspeakably casual about everything.
Yeah. Just in my dad's mind, looks were very important. The way people looked was the key to how you were going to interact with them. And so if your shoes weren't shined, if your hair was messy, these in a man, those were indications that you were not someone worth dealing with. It was that simple.
Yeah.
And so when we were growing up, he tried to enforce those things with us. Shine your shoes, get a haircut, you look a disgrace, all this kind of stuff. And as soon as I got the opportunity to ignore that, I definitely did. Because I thought, and still do, that's a load of bullshit and it really doesn't matter. There's other things. I understand where it comes from, but it's an unhelpful shorthand. You just have to work a bit harder than that to establish whether someone's worth dealing with. You know what I mean?
Yes. You can't deal with people on that level of artifice for very long without, you know, shiny shoes will only get you so far. I bet Pinochet had shiny shoes.
Exactly.
You know, you can't, it can't stop there. The buck cannot stop with the reflective footwear. It really can't. But was he must have been very proud, though. He must have had even though perhaps it wasn't the career he would have...
No, not in the least.
...chosen for you.
No. I don't know. He was very supportive. Mm. And he was always, he was on our TV show and there were times when he felt that we were... pushing the buffoonery too far. Buffoonery!
You go too far.
You go too far. And, you know, we went to Ibiza and Joe, my comedy wife, would be holding the camera, and we'd be in some nightclub, and there was a guy all oiled up with a little thong dancing around on a podium. And Joe said to my dad, go and touch his bum. and my dad said, absolutely not. No. Which is probably right anyway. I don't know how the guy would have felt about it. I think in the end, we just were able to get him to stand near the guy oiled up on the podium. And it was funny, just the juxtaposition of my dad looking angry and uncomfortable next to this guy. But we had a big argument that day. It was too much buffoonery. We pushed him too far. That was the only time I remember that his principles, such as they were, came into conflict with what we wanted from him. The rest of the time, he was game for a laugh. But he didn't get it, and he didn't like it. He didn't like the show.
Ever?
I mean, it was quite weird, the stuff that he responded to. I think he liked it when he would see elements of... there was a character I did called Ken Corder, who was kind of a media, all-purpose media twat. And it was a way that we would spoof kind of pop culture in various ways. And Ken would form a band. It would be like, he'd be a sort of Simon Cowell figure one week, and then another week he'd be a kind of indie filmmaker doing edgy films called Smack Me Up, Gun Bitch, about, you know, it'd be a sort of Trustafarian director doing stuff about heroin-addicted jungle DJs and things like that. So he responded to that stuff because that chimed with his suspicions about how youth culture was a load of crap.
Yes, inauthentic. Yeah.
But he didn't like the toilet humor. He didn't like the swearing. He didn't like anything vulgar. He loathed the grotesque. Was always, I loathe the grotesque. Circuses, carnivals.
Burlesque.
Anything like that. It was just like, no, 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 no. So anytime we strayed into those areas, he wasn't happy.
Where's your mum in all of this?
She is... Well, they didn't get on, so she didn't...
Married and not getting on, or divorced and not getting on?
Married for a long time and not getting on. Because you don't want to get divorced, because then you're going to go to hell.
Oh, so Catholic and...
Not really. I mean, they were religious, but then both of them gave up on it. They never went to church or anything. But I think they still had in their head the hangover of like, no, 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 no. You don't get divorced. That's
part of the
state
of marriage, is perpetual misery anyway.
Exactly. You made your commitment. You stood in front of God and your friends and you promised. You can't break that promise.
In boredom and entropy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they didn't do that. They eventually moved apart when we'd all moved out. Their children had moved out. But
so they then did live separately. They then acknowledged.
Yeah. For the last 20 years of his life or something, he was living alone. But my mum, she thought he was a pain in the ass, you know. So the fact that I think she saw him collaborating with us on all this buffoonery as just being a bit like evidence that he was just a sort of attention seeking dick.
Oh, so she weirdly, you got him on because you knew he'd stay true to himself and that would be funny. That would be the grit in the oyster. But she viewed it as him being just attention-seeking, as you say, and liking the telly.
Just like typical, you know, he goes, he bleats on about this and that, and but then he's happy to go to tribal gathering and smoke a joint.
Did the smoking of a joint wig him out at all? Or
no.
Did he retain...
I'm sorry to say that wow. was the kind of... It wasn't fakery exactly, because he did take a toke, but there's no way he got stoned.
Do you think that it would have broken down some of the defences? Or do you think it's just genetic resolution to...
I mean, he was in the war. In the Second World War, he was in the artillery, D-Day plus four. So going out there in the... I mean, he was back from the lines a bit, so he certainly wasn't one of these guys in super peril. But...
There's still what a modern reality TV show producer would call jeopardy. There's still, I would say, strong jeopardy.
Jeopardy, very scary, very scared. And they gave them pills, you know, they gave them speed. And so
this would make it worse. Why would you give them speed?
Just to stay awake and stay focused.
I mean, I'd be super tense.
Yeah. So they just smoked a load of ciggies, took a load of speed, shat their pants. Because, I mean, you sort of think, fuck it, I'll take anything. Well, probably I'm going to die, so I may as well have a good time.
Yeah.
Obviously, they weren't having a good time. But that was his experience with illegal drugs.
Yeah.
Even though they were handed out by the government. The rest of the time, he was just a massive boozer. But he never got off, he never had those more mellow highs ever. He was always suspicious of them. And then, when in the last months, when he was on the morphine and when he was on a cocktail of pain medication, and it started to fuck with him mentally, and he would have bad dreams, and then he would have dissociation. Did your dad have that?
Yes, he did.
And so...
What kind of cancer did your dad have?
Lining of the lung, mesothelioma. And... for people who haven't had the pleasure of dissociation, it is when, well, essentially, if you've ever taken psychedelic drugs, you might have had a trip where you look in the mirror and you don't know who that person is. You know it's you empirically, but you don't have a connection with that person, and it's a very frightening feeling. And I'd had it when I'd taken mushrooms the only time I took mushrooms.
I've taken mushrooms once and I had exactly that.
Right.
And I was talking to myself, but as you say, without any connection, without any relationship between me and the thing I saw in the mirror.
Yeah, it's frightening.
Yeah. And then my mate Evie turned into the god Pan and I was like, I'm never doing this again.
Right. Never. Yeah. No, I ended up, I was at college and I ended up knocking on someone's door and just sleeping on the floor of their room for the rest of the night because I was so frightened. But, yeah, it's absolutely grim feeling, scary as hell. But I'd had that feeling. And then, so when my dad was ill and he phoned me up, I was in the house, and he said,
Adam?
I said, yes?
The most extraordinary things happened.
I said, what?
I don't know who I am.
I was like, oh, man, here we go. So I go over, and he's all wigged out. Because he's had this thing, because he's been on the morphine, maybe he's taken too much, I don't know, and he's woken up and he's dissociated, and he's never had that before. And so he tells me about it, and it's exactly a description of my thing with the mushrooms. And I'm like, I know exactly what's happened to you. And it was a weird feeling to actually be able to comfort my dad in that way and say, listen, man, you're going to be fine. You've just... wigged yourself out. You're on drugs. This is what it's like being on drugs. You're having a bad trip. And so he had some sugary tea and dunked some biscuits. And I sat there for a while and talked through how he was feeling. And then he came down and it was okay. But he never had that experience, that fun experience with drugs. And it's a shame because I think he liked music. You know, he liked his Ella Fitzgerald and his Dame Kiri Takanawa and his Wagner, of course.
Of course.
And man, he would have got, imagine him getting absolutely baked and listening to Wagner. He would have had a fucking amazing time.
I mean, that's a perfect accompaniment, is it not? Yeah. That's the perfect, oh man, that's what, I had, because we were in like far west Cornwall when Dad was dying, so there wasn't a lot in the way of care available. So it was pretty piecemeal. I remember ringing up and he was having panic attacks and all sorts. And they said, well, do you have any diazepines in the house? And I remember thinking, oh, I've got loads.
I love them.
They're fabulous. And I've got lorazepam. And it just made me confront my own, you know, my own anxiety and panic states. I just have these suitcases of sort of pharmaceutical downers. And I just pop one in each cheek and off he'd go back to sleep. And in the same way as you're saying, you examine your own drugs experience, whether illegal or pharmaceutical, through the prism of somebody else, going through palliative care.
Yeah.
You're thinking, I've got palliative care drugs that have been given to me because I don't like flying.
Yeah.
So I had to sort of rethink after that to sort of go, okay, maybe I shouldn't be routinely taking this. Apparently they're quite addictive.
Are they? I don't know much about them. Are they in the...
They're the benzos. They're the, So I used to just get terrible panic attacks and I would, that was the only thing that would touch the sides.
Yeah.
I mean, I could pop one of those into a full day's work and still be incredibly, that's how high tensile.
A panic attack is, how much of it is physical and how much of it is mental? I mean, I'm sure it varies.
I think the work has been done mentally before the physical symptoms come along. So the physical, you know how we just, you bury stress or you only subconsciously respond to stimuli that are, you know, frightening or confusing. You don't necessarily consciously go, oh, I'm going to make a connection between that and something that happened to me 10 years ago or whatever. So the first thing you're aware of is, for me anyway, is lightheadedness, real tightness in the chest, and then a feeling you're going to have a heart attack. Just and then that feeling might go on for 2 hours.
Because your heart is pounding.
Pounding.
Right, right.
Some people have, actually, some people have disassociation as a symptom.
Oh, really?
Yeah. A friend of mine who goes super calm.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm jealous of her panic attacks. I want her panic attacks. I don't want mine, which are just sort of fire and rage and kind of, oh my God, I'm going to keel over. Yeah. So it would just be like, and I've never really done drugs, but it's just like, these are great because my doctor's given them to me and they make me feel like nothing matters.
Mm.
But that's what all drugs do. They just
flatten you out a bit.
Flatten you out or remove you entirely from a scenario. If you're into your psychedelics, you want to just touch the face of God or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I've never touched the face of God.
No,
have you ever touched the face of God?
No,
would you do an ayahuasca trip with a shaman?
Maybe. I don't know. A friend of mine was talking about going in and doing some psychedelics in kind of lab conditions as a kind of guinea pig.
Oh, man.
And they'd reached out to so-called creative people. And they wanted to test. I mean, it seemed like a bad idea.
Seems like the beginning of a Jordan Peele film.
Yeah. And actually, he hasn't ended up doing it, but he was going to do it. This is another bloke who's a little bit older than me, in fact, and has children and everything. And I think you do get to the stage, especially when you're confident that your children are okay-ish, where you think, maybe it's time to start trying some of these other weird things now and derailing myself a little bit, you know, because you're in such a routine and that becomes a bit depressing after a while. But, I mean, I would be scared. I feel as if the midlife crisis-y part of me, which has definitely kicked in over the last few years, is open to some of those more extreme experiences, but I'm still frightened about it. I still feel as if I'm probably one of those people who's just going to get unhinged. It's going to be Brian Wilson time.
That's what I worry about. That you go on a trip you never return from. And those eyes are almost permanently focused sort of 1,000 miles away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You just look through people when you talk to them.
Also, my whole existence is largely dedicated to managing myself and how I behave and how I come across. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like most people, I suppose, but I'm definitely, you know, because that's what my dad was. He was the whole, it's what we were talking about before. How did these people go through their lives, that generation, keeping everything in, forcing everything down, dealing with it? To them, now we see that as all being negative. But to them, it was a noble thing to do, to not let everything out, to manage all this stuff, to force down any complicated feelings.
Part of the male narrative as well, keep being the repository of pain.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Which, I'll go along with it.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like hardcore. So the midlife crisis, you say, is a couple of years. You're a couple of years in.
Yeah, it's definitely post-dad.
How long does it? Yeah, I think the same probably. Yeah, and we're of a sort of comparable age. How long does it go on for?
Well, I suspect till you die.
But it can't be a midlife crisis to the point of death. Because by definition, then you're end of life. It can't.
No, I'm being silly. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you come out of it the other end. I still, in lots of ways, I feel better than I did a couple of years ago, but...
How does it manifest? Because I can't see you buying a load of Harley Davidsons and...
No, although I was right. I'm trying to write a book. It's been ages. I'm still trying to write this fucking book. But I was writing about like, oh, I think I'm having a midlife crisis. I mean, I'm not riding motorbikes or having affairs with models or jumping out of planes, but I do feel a bit midlife crisis-y. And then the next week it was my 50th birthday and my present from my wife was skydiving vouchers.
Did you do it?
I haven't done it yet, but I am going to do it because it was quite a good present. I was like, wow, yes, I'm definitely up for skydiving. So maybe I'm up for affairs with models and Harley Davidsons.
Well, be honest, if you do, then you can... it's fair to blame her. You say you were the gateway.
Exactly.
You were the portal into the door.
No, how does it manifest itself? I don't know. As a kind of all-encompassing existential meltdown panic about questioning everything I've ever done and everything I've ever thought.
Your place in the world.
Yeah, and wondering
just why,
what to retain and what to jettison, whether certain things can be repaired, whether I'm thinking too much. I mean, I'm definitely thinking too much about all this stuff, but trying to recalibrate and restabilize. And after years, at least the first 30 years of my life, of just thinking, I'm great. And I'm fun, and I'm nice, and I'm just going to have a nice time. And that's all there is to it. And then suddenly, gradually thinking, I'm not sure that's the whole story, is it? And then getting more and more, I don't know about this. And then dead dad, it's like, oh, fuck. Okay, I've got to rethink.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by HelloFresh. HelloFresh is the UK's leading recipe box service, delivering fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes to your door. It's the easy, convenient way to cook delicious dinners from scratch. Perfect for anyone who doesn't have time to prepare their own meals or just isn't very good at cooking. You get to choose your favourites from 19 recipes every week, including rapid recipes which will be ready in 20 minutes or less. They offer family favourites, British and world cuisine, including beef kofta curry and za'atar spiced chicken. So last week, I had the beetroot, green bean and orange salad, which was from the balance range. This week, I had the creamy roasted vegetable curry, which was perfect for this time of year. It's part of the rapid range, so it took less than 20 minutes to cook, which was great after a busy day and getting home late. It's flexible, so you can change the size of your delivery, as well as when and where you want it delivered. To sign up for your first box, head to hellofresh.co.uk, choose a box, a delivery slot, and add your favourite recipes. All their fresh ingredients come direct from suppliers, pre-portioned, so there's no food waste. There's also a great selection of veggie options. HelloFresh are offering our listeners £60 off 4 boxes. Visit www.hellofresh.co.uk and enter the code OUR at the checkout to enjoy delicious dinners without the drama.
Do you do that thing where you calculate at what point you think you'll cark it and how many years that is, and then track back to? So I sort of think maybe I've got another 35 years. That would mean from when I was 15 to like.
Is that
now,
because that's
14.
When your dad died? Was he 85?
No, he was 82.
All right.
Okay. But I'm going to give myself a little bit longer than him because he smoked for longer than I did, sure. And his diet was shit.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. Death maths.
And and I'm much more fortunate than he. I had a good education and incredibly privileged. I've got an easier life. Mm-hmm. Plus, women live a bit longer than men. I factored all that in. But 15 to like 49 has gone like that. So the idea you've got that much again is like, that's the thing that keeps me awake at night. And what you do with it, and why the tired, sad stuff comes at the end and not at the beginning when you have the resolve to deal with it. And
I know, that's the kick in the nuts, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, no, stop dying, everyone. I'm tired, I can't deal with it. But also I think, I think I was probably harder on myself from 0 to 30 than I am now. Now I kind of give myself a bit more latitude.
Mm-hmm. I feel as if I'm getting to that point, a sort of good enough philosophy.
But what more? This is the thing. It's like, what do you affix your sense of self-worth to when you look back? Because, I mean, you're a parent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, which I've not had the pleasure of being. But that must give you a good, solid sense of achievement, as well as then the work.
No.
No? So you think you've...
No, that's the core of the terror, is that I didn't think hard enough before I brought 3 lives into this world. And I am a stupid person in a lot of ways. And how have I got the right to be in charge of these 3 human beings? I'm not in sole charge of them. Luckily, my wife is also involved and she's much nicer and cleverer than I am. But in dark moments, those are the thoughts, you know? Like, most of the time, it is lovely, and I...
So you feel that you've malprogrammed them? You've kind of...
I just feel like I'm a bad example.
Why? You pursue your dream, and you are authentic.
Am I? I don't know. You know, you have these thoughts.
Sure. So
these are the dark thoughts you have sometimes, as you question absolutely everything. You get yourself into a kind of very elaborate loop of second guessing and anxiety and worrying. And then you think, holy shit, what's that kind of behavior doing to them? They're going to pick up on all this, whether they know it or not. And I mean, one way or another, you're going to screw up your children, right?
I'd like to be able to say no, but... I don't know. I think the best you can hope for maybe is that you've given them the emotional, the capacity to be able to talk to you about all things, including how screwed up they are.
No, I hope so. I hope so.
I think that's what makes my brother's a brilliant dad, and that's and his wife is a brilliant mum. And I look at them and I think those kids are great because even though they're as fucked up as everybody else, maybe. They can go and say, I feel this and I think this and what do you reckon? And they will be able to have a conversation. And that's maybe what we weren't able to do with our parents.
Yeah.
You went to them and they were like, oh, this is awkward.
Yeah.
The child is leaking emotion. the algorithm has no capacity to cope with this.
Yeah, yeah. Then my parents, my dad's generation, thought that if you start talking about those things, it'll become a self-fulfilling prophecy. You will encourage, you know, it was that philosophy of like, if you start indulging these thoughts, they will get worse and they will take on a life of their own. And, you know, I mean, it is, it's something I worry about. I don't know. The middle ground is the way to go.
But who occupies that? I don't know. Do you know anyone who occupies a middle ground?
Adam Gopnik. Do you know who he is?
No.
He's a journalist. He writes for The New Yorker. He's written a book about liberalism called A Thousand Small Sanities. And it's a defense of the middle ground, of a liberal, in the old sense of the word, midpoint way of thinking. And it's an examination of how things have become so polarized. And he... in a very liberal, balanced way, examines what's good about the right and what's good about the left and what's bad and hypocritical about both sides. It's a good book. I recommend it to people who are interested in that middle ground. But, who occupies the middle ground? I'm sure even Adam Gopnik, strays.
Yeah, I mean, for the purposes of a book, he's managed to do that, but I wonder how much in real life.
Well, exactly, like, exactly.
You just...
That's the thing. But that's the thing that drives me nuts on social media is that people act as if that never happens to them. They act as if they, you know, they cast out judgments. And I always feel as if there should be a little asterisk and to just indicate like, P.S., I fuck up too. I'm not always like this. I have a few videos that I have a few views that may be considered unpalatable by some people who agree with me politically. You know, all this kind of thing. I want the caveats and the clauses.
There's no nuance.
But there's no
characters.
No, there's no room for the clauses.
And even if you were to write down all the disclaimers, then it, with every one you would lose followers, I guess, because they're there for a sort of highly specified message that they think you can deliver.
Yeah, because it's very seductive to have everybody's attracted to people who seem to know what's going on, you know. You realize when you work with directors in showbiz, that a good director is someone who just projects some sense of they know what's going on.
Yeah.
Even though they don't, all they have to do is, like they don't always get it right, but they always make a decision. And that's all anyone wants. It's like, please, can someone make a decision? You know, and it's like, yep, we're going to do this. Move the camera over there, do that over there, we're going to do that line differently there, and everyone's happy, even if it's a load of bullshit. And even if it turns, that's why so many bad films come out and the directors keep working, because they're just good at getting it done. And
Michael
that's
Bay makes decisions.
Yeah, exactly.
That's just
Joel Schumacher knows where to put the camera, absolutely, definitely.
I'm sure there's a DOP shaking his head going, it's not Joel Schumacher doing that, it's us, it's
yeah,
crew
that's
doing
true.
That.
That's quite
a thing.
Right.
I mean, increasingly,
yeah.
It's like...
Of course, it's a team effort, but you need one person who's just who's projecting that sense of confidence and that they know absolutely what the right thing to do. And what you don't want is someone wandering around going, I don't know, I mean, there's got to be a middle ground.
That is me, though. I can't make any decisions.
Yeah, same here.
It's all shadow puppetry, isn't it? It's the tiny little wizened hands doing bunny ears, and some of these huge scales and menacing creature appears on the screen. And for us, it's like, I think...
It's like the Dark Crystal.
You know, it's like we're broadcasting, I think there's a sense of maybe people think, oh, yeah, well, they at least can author their own opinions. I can't, I mean, almost minute by minute can't author my own opinions, because it just takes somebody strong to counter me, and my natural porous, sappy, empathetic self will want to find some reason and rationale
of course,
what they're saying.
And most people are like that, hence the popularity of the Trumps and the Johnsons and those kinds of strong personalities where people are just dazzled by the confidence. And they think, well, maybe that's worth a go. He seems to really know what he wants.
Why do we need a parliament?
Yeah.
We don't need a parliament. We just need that guy with the hay bale hair. Just...
You know, but for me, the Johnson thing is like, I sometimes feel as if I would be more pro him if it weren't for the for that double Brexit article thing. You know, the way he wrote the two editorials about staying
the pro and con.
Yeah. And I just thought, there you go. That's all you need to know about you. You really are a fence sitter, and you really are just playing this for your
own
advantage.
And yet when a side is picked for him, or he sort of falls over one side, he doubles down to such an extent that he will ignore parliamentary democracy, the rule of law, anything. Just for what? To be... In a way, he's sort of... God, it's Faust. It's like he's screwed, man. He's screwed, whatever happens.
Yeah.
Even if he triumphs and wins all the general elections, he's corroded. He's nothing.
Yeah.
He's dead at heart.
Probably our listeners never even thought about that before, and we're like springing it on them. I know you thought Donald Trump was a genius, but we don't think he is. What about that? Deal with that.
Yeah, deal with that reality.
Watch out.
So and look, yet he sort of is a genius, Donald Trump, the bogeyman that straight out of the 1930s Germanic playbook, isn't it?
I mean, I can't rule out a future in which Donald Trump is seen as some sort of visionary who swept things aside and, oh, he did a lot of good.
Just a normal guy, right?
But, you know, of course, the truth of it, of any political figure, is that they will have, along with a load of horrible things, they will have done some things that were okay, you know, and probably did help a few people. But then you have to, the historical judgment will be a process of trying to balance those and thinking, well, on the whole, though, we don't like them.
But also, society is a slow car, so you can turn the key, you can make the policy decisions, but the actual effects take a while. So
yeah.
You can't match the shifts in societal development to immediately, chronologically to a leader, can you?
No, exactly. It's like when Malcolm Gladwell wrote The Tipping Point and there was all that stuff about Giuliani clearing up New York and how he transformed it with the broken windows, zero tolerance policy for small infractions of the law, and how that had transformed what New York was like, and the crime rate went right down, and hooray! And it was very much portrayed as a total win, and a genius bit of counterintuitive policy making. But then, of course, it criminalized a whole generation of young black people who were being given criminal records for small infractions.
40 and years for
their lives were ruined.
A cookie,
you know,
stolen, or
yeah. So there's all those things that you just can't think about. But one of the things that Gopnik says in his book, A Thousand Small Sanities, about liberalism is that the whole project of liberalism is this never-ending thing of just making small adjustments. You try and go in the right direction, you try and do the right thing, and then you realize, oh, it's got all these unforeseen consequences which are pretty bad, and we've got to recalibrate. But that doesn't invalidate the entire project, you know. You still have to, you can easily point to all the failures and evil things that have been done in the name of liberalism or whatever. But on the whole, you have to still say, okay, but it's this middle ground is still worthwhile. We still have to kind of keep pushing forward here a little bit, even though it's not as glamorous as being...
There's nothing sexy about that.
No, right? Exactly.
There's nothing. It's all but disappeared. And you sort of feel like a cultural irrelevance putting your hand up and going, can we just coalesce around a kind of consensus of, as you say, the middle ground? It's not. I wonder how long that's going to disappear for now.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would say 6 years.
Okay, I'm not holding you to it. 6.5 years. Six and a half years. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I'm looking to Khaleesi to see if Khaleesi agrees.
Nice segue callback. I was just about to go back to Belfast. So you can tell us, what is the significance of Belfast and the throne?
So it's filmed on the Antrim coast. So all that gorgeousness of sort of Jon Snow kind of hopping off a dragon and looking out to sea with his sort of 1,000-yard stare is all filmed. Am I right, Khaleesi? Khaleesi is nodding. And everywhere you go in Belfast now, it's just rows of Asian tourists dressed as Daenerys, and it's absolutely hilarious and magnificent.
Yeah.
And sort of completely...
And they're working on the prequels now, right?
They are, yeah. Yeah. I mean, all I know is they filmed a pilot, Blood Moon. Which one is it? Were you into Thrones? Are you a sort of fantasy genre guy?
I'm not... I was invited once or twice onto Thronecast and always said no because I would have felt a fraud because I'm not that deep level. But I did watch. I watched them all, you know.
I loved it. I mean, I just love the scale.
Yeah.
Just the scale of it.
Sure.
But I kind of liked it when there was sort of seasons 5 and 6. It got very HBO-y, almost like Succession.
Yes.
Which is a work of obvious genius. But I like the sort of... behind room kind of politics stuff.
Uh-huh.
When it was sort of CGI dragon shit, I was less, you know what I mean? When it was just let's banger on a green screen and we'll do the rest in post.
The massive battles.
Yeah.
Although there was one massive battle, I can't remember which series it was, but I remember Jon Snow was in there and I remember they were surrounded.
Battle of the Bastards. Was at one point he was sort of...
climbing over a mountain of...
Yes.
Yeah. And... I said to my wife, Sue...
You've gone too far.
I turned to my wife and I said, this is just so brilliantly directed. I actually said that. But I just, you know, it's not... I'm not normally critiquing the...
it was amazing.
But I just like, fuck. You realise, like, when you watch a shit action film...
Yeah.
Like, you watch one of the less good Bourne films or whatever, and you just... The camera's shaking around, you're like... What the fuck is going on? Where is he? Is he on the stair? Who's he punching? Well, I don't know what is even happening. Mm. But in that battle scene, incredibly complicated. And yet it was just, I was like, wow, this is magnificent. You get a sense of what is going on and who's doing
the
what.
Claustrophobia. And, yeah. And there's no CGI in that. It's just bodies on the ground.
Right.
If you saw the making of documentary, they had all the sort of big strapping Belfast lads who'd come in time and time again to play.
Oh yes, I did
fourth,
see that. Yeah,
fourth
yeah.
corpse from the left. But what I love about that scene is the what they've done with the sound.
Uh-huh.
So the sound slowly gets muffled the more bodies pile on top
right.
of it. It's incredible. Than that, you just think, oh man, I'm watching something so complete. Every department has just bust a nut to make sure. I mean, I think. I don't know. For me, that's like the finest hour plus of television, because it has the scope of cinema, but the intimacy of just you can be in your front room.
Yeah, that was the peak for me, I think.
Absolutely.
So you didn't sign the angry petition telling them to remake the series. Remake it. We don't like the way it ended. We think you should remake it.
Other series are available. Yeah, I mean, listen.
Can you imagine if they actually gave in to the pressure to remake, to spunk away all the money to fucking remake it.
What do you want, guys? Let's sit down and talk.
A bunch of angry fucking nerds would be happy.
But they'd find no consensus. That's the thing. If they said to those, how many people signed it in the end? A million people or something? You go, okay, we're going to send out emails to a million people. What do you want?
Yeah.
Just so divergent and furious. And one of the guys in it, actually, we went over and talked to the cast, and He said it's like supporting a football team, supporting Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. You have your tribal affiliation. You will be for Daenerys or for Jon Snow, or, and you are unwavering in your diehard loyalty. And if anything happens to them, you just shit a brick. And that's what happened, I think. It's for the Daenerys fans. They were like, what the actual fuck? And then they just started petitioning. And
yeah.
And that's testament to how, you know, how captivating it was, is that people would... bother. I mean, so rarely do you sign a petition these days, even though it's easy.
I mean, I was upset because it was my daughter's birthday was coming up. I had got her a Daenerys USB key, and then that happened, and I was like, well, that's fucked now.
Yeah. The thing is, I mean, how old is she?
She's 10.
Yeah, I mean, everyone, I mean, just the right age for a USB key.
Yeah, it was a very slow key as well, though.
Really?
Yeah, sometimes, you know, you buy those, they're really quite elaborate. You know, I got an R2-D2 one as well. I was like, wow, this looks just like R2-D2. This is great. But holy Moses, it takes about an afternoon to transfer a single Word document.
Absolutely. But you picked the wrong, you backed the wrong horse
there. Absolutely. Big
style. Livid.
You know what? She didn't even
go there.
Know that much about it. I mean, because it's too much, I think, for her. She's quite sensitive to what is appropriate for her and what is not. We gathered around the other night.
Is she self-censoring because you'll let her watch anything?
Yeah, pretty much, I think, because the boys were so keen. I have my two boys are older, 15 and 17, and I was probably too liberal with them, I think. but with her,
how bad was it? What's the most liberal dad thing you did?
The thing that was most embarrassing, I think, that I showed them was what was the film from the late 80s about football? The Firm.
Oh, yeah.
With Gary Oldman.
Yeah.
Really violent.
Super violent.
Thing about football yobs knifing each other and getting into
fights.
How
old were they?
So that was a couple of years ago. So 13 and 15. I think the 15-year-old was like, meh. But the 13-year-old took himself upstairs. He was like, Dad, I'm not into this. So he went up and I thought, oh, I'm bad. I'm a bad parent. And then I had it again the other day when my mum was round, and she's now in her 80s and she's getting, in her words, a bit batty. Oh, I'm getting batty. I'm quite batty now. And she is a bit batty, but she likes champagne. So when she comes round, we'll get her some champagne. And she'll just drink all the champagne and get batty, and we'll watch a movie in the evening, and she'll just ask a load of questions right the way through the film. But I thought, well, what can we all watch? And I read some reviews, and I thought, well, let's go for a romantic comedy, something like that. That'll be nice. So I read a load of reviews. Reviews in the modern world, they are worth absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Fucking Rotten Tomatoes and all those review aggregators. What a load of
TripAdvisor for Hollywood.
I mean, they are so easily skewed. They are entirely meaningless. And so...
which one did you choose?
We chose Longshot, a romantic comedy with Charlize Theron and
Seth Rogen.
Seth Rogen.
Yeah, which I had to go and see at the cinema.
Did you?
Yes, I did.
And I read a load of reviews saying, this is... delightful fun. This is naughty Seth Rogen fun. It's a little cheeky round the edges, but it's intelligent and it's solid and moving and funny. And Charlize Theron is marvellous. And Seth Rogen is charming as a political journalist who's become disillusioned.
Yeah, so online journalist, isn't he? He's a sort of, yeah.
Yeah, and he's a, you know, he's like a, he used to have loads of, he's got loads of principles, so he gets fired from his job at the paper because he wants to tell the truth, but the paper just
can't handle the truth.
Can't handle the truth, so he gets fired. But Charlize Theron is running for president, and she used to be his babysitter, and he fancied her, and she remembers what a good guy he was.
And there was an incident with him wanking, wasn't there?
Right, and she saw him.
And he was 13. And
so she ends up hiring him as her speech writer. And saucy hilarity ensues. And I thought, well, that'll be fine. It'll probably be a bit edgy, but I'm sure it'll be fine. So I gathered the whole family around to watch Longshot. And It is, and my daughter, after 20 minutes, after the first full-on sex scene,
yeah,
my daughter pulled a blanket over her head on the sofa and just said, "Daddy, this is not appropriate."
I'm now understanding why you're having these long, dark nights of the soul, yeah, with your parenting.
Well, exactly.
So she's gone budgie and put the thing over. So your mum...
So my wife is like, as soon as people start stripping off, she makes the noise, you know. And then my daughter...
Is that the exact noise she makes?
Yeah. Nudge, nudge, nudge. And then like, you know, daughter pulls the blanket over her. This is not appropriate. My mum's like, "Who is that young woman? Is she? Is that Gwyneth Paltrow?" And I'm thinking, oh, I don't know if this film is right. And that's even before we've got to a scene where they're having sex and Charlize Theron, this like, she's running for president. She's a kind of alpha woman, really super powerful, intelligent, cool. And she's having sex with Seth Rogen and she... they haven't got much time. They're all in a fluster, but they really, really want to have sex. And so she goes, come on. Just do it to me doggy style. Smack my butt a few times and kind of choke me a little, she says.
Mm. Well, that's classic rom-com fare, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm amazed, like, Richard Curtis hasn't done more strangulation movies. Well, I didn't get the memo.
When did feminism get to this point where that's good?
I want to run the free world, but also I want to be half choked in doggy position.
And that's, and then there's the bit where Seth Rogen is wanking over her on his computer and comes in his beard, which we see.
We do see.
And so my mum luckily didn't know what was going on from one moment to the next.
Oh, it's good. She's the batty is kind of, it means she can't see semen.
What did Gwyneth Paltrow say about smacking her? And then my children all checked out.
You've reminded me how intense it was. It's not Notting Hill. It is not.
It's a very odd film.
I almost want to just to leave people with that image of the president of the United States on all fours. Because what we learn from that film is women like power, but not too much. Take it away from us.
Yeah,
just subjugate us. Because it just gets relentless being in control.
Sure, every now and again you just want to get choked by a nerd before he comes in his beard.
And that is how I want to end everything. Thank you. Thank you.
Nice to talk to you, Sue.
And you too, darling. Thanks for listening. As always, you can post reviews at Apple Podcasts. All the music in this episode was provided by Waiting for Smith. And if you want to check out more Waiting for Smith, then go to Spotify. There are no more. When the fountains all cease to flow, I'll be there if you want me to. When the marble has turned to clay and the people have all turned grey and the Romans don't walk so slow, I'll be there if you want me to. I'll be there if you want me to. Oh, it's fair to say I'll be there every day.